Hi, my name is Jordan. I am a special education teacher from the UK. I share my passion for everything communication, sensory regulation, and fun lesson ideas for my classroom of disabled pupils aged 4 to 11. Each week, I am joined by experts in the field, answering your questions and sharing our knowledge and experience working alongside our beautiful young people. Let's get started. Welcome back to another live. We're going to be joined by Anna today, who is an early years and SEND specialist and has designed her own curriculum to meet the absolute growing need, and I'm sure you guys are aware of this as well, the absolute growing need of SEND in mainstream, especially in early years, because they often haven't got their EHCP yet, so haven't got, you know, gone to a special school or specialist classroom like mine. So yeah, mainstream are having to manage that, and she's created her own curriculum and way of working with that, and I'm really excited to speak to her. The most exciting thing, I think, is that she was actually nominated to be part of this podcast by one of her colleagues, and I just think that is the most wonderful thing. So the fact that her colleagues think so highly of her, that they were saying to me, she's amazing, she does such great work, she has to be on your podcast, she's got so much to share. I just thought, oh yeah, of course. What a compliment to have your colleague say that about you. So I'm really excited to meet Anna. Yeah, let's get her on.
Hello.
How are you?
Not too bad, thank you.
Yeah, so I was just saying that you were nominated by one of your colleagues to do this.
Yes, I certainly was.
This is the biggest compliment ever, can I just say.
Well, I have an amazing team around me, so they could all be here as well, talking it through.
And what is your team look like? How many, you know, adults are in there? And it's mainstream, right?
Yeah, mainstream. So we're a single form entry school. I'm the full-time class teacher, but I'm also the early years lead. So I oversee our nursery as well, which takes from two. So there's two rooms for me to oversee, but I lead in one because I have an awesome nursery team who just need me to check in and support once in a while. So my classroom is myself, and then I've got one full-time TA, but that full-time TA might be different on different days. We might occasionally get a third adult every now and then, but very rarely.
Okay. And how many children are in your class?
So we have a pan of 30. I'm normally sort of in the mid-20s. This year we are at 18, and as everyone's probably very aware, the birth rate is just dropping and dropping. So 18 is actually a really healthy number for our area. Of those, I've got 5 children that either have or need to have an EHCP and further diagnosis and investigation.
Okay, so you're managing your class, you're supporting these 5 children, not only through teaching in your class, but also with the paperwork. There's a hell of a lot of work that goes into getting that provision and getting that support, isn't there?
There is.
What does that look like? Because this is something that I don't know about. I get lots of questions about the EHC process. It's something that I've never been involved with. I do lots of work with EHCPs, but I'm never the one that starts the process because they've already got them by the time they come to me, which is a huge luxury.
Yes.
So could you just explain to me from entry what information you're told or not told on, you know, maybe it's different for every child, but yeah, a bit of that. And then also, how do you start gathering information? What does that look like? What's the process of that?
So like you say, it's different depending on the level of need of the child or the nursery that they've come from. So sometimes children come to us with absolutely zero done in terms of any sort of evidence gathering, any sort of what would have been known as like an IEP a few years ago. So any sort of provision map that's like targeting a small step over a period of time and then being reviewed. So if they come with none of those, so if I think back to 2 years ago, I had 3 non-verbal children join me in the space of 3 weeks, one after the other, and none of them had anything done. So they had already been in a reception setting elsewhere and then joined partway through the academic year, but had zero paperwork in place. So it means starting from scratch. So you need to start with building a provision map so that you can start building evidence that you are trying to target really small steps that are behind their peers, and that the high quality then the intervention that you're putting in is either showing very, very small progress or not showing a lot of progress at all. You need to get other agencies involved as well, which in this day and age is getting harder and harder. So Most recent speech and language referral that was done by my nursery team only came through a couple of weeks ago. So that was about 11 months waiting for just the triage phone call. So it's really important to get the other agencies in and those referrals done as quickly as possible, because you need all of the agencies involved to actually contribute towards the part one of the EHCP.
And that's even if they're NHS, if they're private, then it's a whole different ballgame, because then you've got to try and convince the school to pay, you know, or pay, sometimes parents are paying privately for these things just to get the reports. It's an absolute mess, isn't it? And ultimately what that means is, if it's taken 11 months, that means, well, they've definitely gone through nursery without the financial support and the, you know, the legal requirement support. But often they end up in year one by the time they get access in this position.
It's not uncommon these days for a child. So if I have a child join me in reception class in September with zero evidence gathered for whatever reason, it isn't uncommon for them to be either just leaving year one or just entering year two before an EHCP has been agreed by the county and funding provided. However, funding these days isn't a huge amount. So of my five in my current class, one child has his EHCP, mainly based on a medical need over any other need. His EHCP, if it's broken down in terms of how much we get funding wise, it covers about an hour and 20 a day.
And needs full time, or needs a lot?
Needs full time.
Yeah. So even with it, there are still huge battles and barriers, aren't there, to learning. And you've got quite a high need, I can imagine, coming in as well, if they're non-speaking medical needs. Without giving, we don't want to give any personal information here, but what kind of needs are you seeing in a more of generic terms? Would it be similar to in mine, for example?
I believe so. It's getting more and more as though it's like a specialist classroom or unit based within a mainstream school. So you've got your communication and language, which we've seen over the last few years has been dipping fairly significantly for neurotypical children as well as our neurodiverse. And that's something to consider when you're the reception teacher, is I might have some children that have got zero speech currently, and we are trying to find a way to support their development of language through visuals or through sign language, whatever sort of we feel is most beneficial to them. But you also have children that are neurotypical and are not meeting their age related expectations, because there's a speech and language delay for them as well, so they need your one-to-one attention just as much as your high need children. So that's really complex to do as a teacher when there's two bodies in the room and everyone needs you. That's really hard to plan for and consider, because otherwise your neurotypicals begin to fall behind, because you're having to put so much energy into your diverse children who have significant need that you're gathering all this evidence for, to be able to get them the paperwork that they need, to be able to get the funding that they deserve, and eventually maybe in time a place in a specialist setting where they might flourish.
Yeah, so that's speech and language, and there are lots of reasons, I'm sure, why speech and language is low across the board, and we're seeing similar in my mainstream school as well. I think it's across the board, it's just quite poor, isn't it? I think it comes down to parents ultimately not knowing how to support that language development at those early stages, doesn't it? Let's call it what it is. And similar for fine motor skills, I'm sure you're finding as well. Folding pens, pencils, mark making. Are you finding similar in that kind of area as well?
We find that our physical isn't quite as low as our language, but it is definitely something that has dipped over time. And it's very apparent which children attend nursery settings more regularly than others, because they get the high quality language, they get the bedtime stories, they get the nursery rhymes, all those things that are needed to help grow that vocabulary and model that speech, which I think sometimes parents are in such a busy, stressful world these days are forgetting that actually a 5-minute bedtime story has so much potential to do so much good to your child's development, that actually, and singing a nursery rhyme in the car rather than having the radio on or having the child in their tablet on will give so much language development. But it's really hard to get that across to people who are working busy lives and maybe forget that actually they only need 5 minutes to do something that could be really, really positive.
Yeah, and there's also on that as well, that's an environmental experience, isn't it? But there's also lots of unnoticed or unfound, you know, physical reasons why they might have a speech delay as well, isn't there? And then there's also trauma and all sorts of things like that. So, and or, or they have got a neurodiversity, and that's just showing there. Yeah, you know, there's so many different reasons. But in this early year stage, you've got such a huge diverse range, haven't you? Because you haven't been able to sort these children out into their appropriate provisions yet with the appropriate support. So if you know then, right, these kids have come in, we know that even if we start the paperwork, even if we do an amazing job now, we know we've got them for early years. Yep. Like that's just almost guaranteed. We've got them for early years. What's the next step? We've got these kids. I've only got one support in my room. There's me, there's one support. We've got 25 kids, 18 kids. What does that look like? Because that's a huge diverse need.
Yeah. I mean, communication language is only one of the needs. We have some different levels of ASD. Some have already been diagnosed, which would then indicate at such a young age, it was picked up at a very, very young age and therefore has already been diagnosed through the right pathway. Diagnosis doesn't change anything. It doesn't give them any funding. It doesn't give them a strategy moving forward. So some of them have a diagnosis. Some of them need a diagnosis, which is, again, a different form of paperwork to then be starting for that family and that child alongside trying to get their EHCP. We also are seeing an increase in PDA and ODD joining in at school now, which has been very complex because it's a challenge in mainstream that you have one classroom. You are set in one room. For me, as early years, I have a little outside area that's attached to my room that we can then do inside and outside provision at the same time. But again, with only two adults, that means one adult outside, one adult inside. So it is challenging in terms of our environments, our settings. Traditionally, old set up primary schools with the hall probably in the middle of the school, and then you've probably got the infant end one side, a junior end the other, with classrooms both sides. They're not designed for children that need regular breakout spaces, and they're not designed for children that need a quiet space over there, but I also could do with a dark space over there because I actually get stimulated by the lights, so I need a sensory area over here. There's a lot of our teachers and teaching assistants these days that know what needs to happen, but we not only are sort of stuck with our funding, we are stuck with our space. So it's about being really clever with what space you do have, accepting that you might get written on some reports from outside professionals that this child needs a blackout tent, this child needs a swing, this child needs a chair that spins. You're not going to be able to offer all of these things. You need to find the thing that will benefit that child the most and see what you can do in terms of offering it. A blackout space can be a table against the wall with a piece of fabric over it. It doesn't have to be anything costly to start with. Yeah. If you can work out that, okay, actually a blackout tent really does work for this child, then you can look at where you can get the funding streams for it. Or you can take that to your senior leadership team and say, actually, I've tried this. It's reduced the amount of emotional dysregulation we've had. This child clearly does need something. And then because you're able to prove that actually we haven't had so many issues, the child's been able to access learning, which means the rest of the peers in the classroom can access their learning, then you can target the provision that you actually need. But back to your question about sort of what you do, apart from sitting there and panicking for quite a while and thinking, oh my goodness, how am I going to do this? That's where sort of my supporting program of Blossom sort of came in. We've had increased sort of need over the last sort of 6 years in my school, but about 3 years ago, we had rapid increase and we were getting three or four high need children that would be off curriculum or couldn't access the current curriculum entering at a time. And in mainstream, that was not normal. You would have maybe one high need and it wouldn't necessarily be every cohort either. And I found it really challenging to not know where to turn. As a teacher, you get 2 hours of planning time a week, if you're lucky, and you haven't got enough time in those 2 hours to plan for the rest of your curriculum and the whole neurotypical children and the adaptations that you need and all of that, that I found that I was losing at least one day of the weekend every weekend to then plan for my neurodiverse children who were off curriculum and not accessing the curriculum. I personally find it really interesting, and it's an area that I research a lot about, sort of how to support children with need and families with need and what can we do, because it's not going away. Even if I was able to get them all EHDPs tomorrow, there's not enough room in settings like yours for children to go. So they are going to stay in mainstream. So it was a, what can we do about it? And then speaking to colleagues that either work with myself or speaking to other professionals online in forums like this, it was becoming really apparent that people were close to leaving the profession because they felt completely lost with, what am I supposed to do? I haven't got the training to do this. We might do a CPD on autism, which is an hours long video that you have to watch in a staff meeting after a really busy day, and you actually haven't taken all of it in, or you've not actually seen it in practice. For me, it was about, how can we help teachers with their workload? How can we think that actually our profession has such a high dropout rate? And it's not because we don't love our jobs, we love what we do, but you can't lose your weekends every weekend because you're fighting a battle of, how am I doing my planning for these children that don't fit in the mainstream curriculum? And that's what Blossom is. Blossom is for staff to have a look at, to be able to then say, okay, developmentally, it's not a curriculum. It's not going to give you your planning for next week. But what it will do is give you developmental steps for each area of the early years curriculum. So, for example, at 9 to 12 months, what sort of things would we expect a child to do in terms of communication and language? Do they know their own name? So do we know that? Do they stop and look? They don't have to look at you, but do they stop and look around when their name is verbalised from somewhere else in the classroom? If that's what a child needs to be doing, if a child is not doing that every time you say their name, then there's a target there that you could look at in terms of planning for them to move forward.
That's great. It gives you a focus, doesn't it? Rather than thinking, well, they can't do this, they can't do this, they can't do this. Like, okay, well, what can they do? Let's look at that age range of, see what else a child at that developmental stage, what they would be also learning. Yeah. And let's see if our children can also focus on those things. It gives it so much focus, doesn't it? And it helps you to see what they are achieving rather than just what they're not.
Yeah, that was a huge thing, was being able to take the Blossom sheets. So it's a colour-coded sheet that myself and my team can track against. So every half term, like I do with everybody else, although we're, you know, assessing as you go all the time, when it comes to your half term data drops, like I do with the rest of the class, I can go through their Blossom sheets and I can see, actually, maybe the child is still within 9 to 12 months in their communication. However, they were entering at the beginning of this, and now I'd say they're developing. So we can start looking at securing some of the steps that they haven't got, and then moving on. It just gives something to look at that isn't out of their reach, and it helps the parents when I show them that, look at where your child's moved. It might not look very clear that they've moved, but look at what they've managed to do in the last 6 weeks by actually targeting a step that's inclusive to them. Because it's not important for me that if a child can't communicate their basic needs or doesn't respond to their name, they don't need to come and listen to me talking about the Arctic explorers and emperor penguins. Of course they can join in with the provision in their own play and learn time, but they don't need to know that, and I don't need to assess whether they've taken anything on board. This is actually, what do they need? So to be inclusive in the classroom for them, what do they need?
Absolutely. Someone said it fit perfectly. It said it's all about the small steps leading to the big steps. Yeah. I can imagine it also helps parents as well, because yes, you sometimes get parents, you know, wanting to know what's next and all of that kind of thing, but you also get some parents as well that are completely disillusioned about how disabled their children are, and especially if they're an only child or they're the oldest. It's really hard because you have no one else to compare against. They might know they're struggling a little bit in reading, but they don't know what that means or what that looks like or what to work on. the other way, they might perfectly know where their child's at, but again, not know what to look for, how to support them, because it doesn't look like how their other siblings did things. You know, they did phonics, they did this. Yeah. What does it look like for my child? I want to get this right. So yeah. On that sheet, if they're part of it, which I'm sure you do, that holistic kind of team around the child approach, like early years is so good at, they can then also look for those things and feel good about where they're at and feel fully understanding. And then also when you're doing the reports for the AHCP, it perfectly says the age there, the developmental stage. It shows, yes, what they're achieving, but also what they can't achieve yet. And that would definitely support the report writing process massively, I can only assume.
Yeah, and that's something I thought about carefully when creating it. There's that my county will only accept the developmental journal that the county have produced. So Blossom, again, thinking about workload, I don't want it to be challenging for this information to have to fit onto the developmental journals. This transfers very easily into the developmental journal, so that it can just be a quick tick box exercise, because our developmental journal for the county probably needs looking at. It's rather outdated and still uses the age brackets of the 2014 early years curriculum, so it is outdated. However, that's the only one that they accept. They wouldn't accept Blossom as a document on its own as a supporting evidence, but it helps me to write it, so that's where the benefit comes in. I can use that to track them daily, to create their learning tasks. It goes inside their learning journeys, so from Blossom I will pull out the statements that I want us to focus on, so whether it's, you know, turning their head when their name is vocalized or indicating that they've heard their name. I then come up with at least 5 steps of progression for how this might look in terms of an activity in the classroom to make it harder and harder as it goes through. That gets stuck into their learning journeys with the Blossom targets for the half term, so that the staff, because I don't have the same staff every day, although my main staff member is with me a lot of the time, we have a lot of complex need and people are needed in different rooms for different reasons. You can pick up the learning journey and see exactly what step they're working on and at what level. And I have something called a learning library set up, which is a group of trays. Each child is color coded in my room for their independence. So they go to their schedule. So if they're the red child, they go to the red schedule. They take off their red visual for their tray. They go and put it on their first tray and all their learning is inside that tray. So they don't have to then have that anxiety of, oh no, she's going to ask me to do maths in a minute. I really don't want to do maths. But the way I've used the schedules is to have a location. It might say red child number, task number one. It might have a picture of outside. So we know when you go and get your tray, we're going to need to go outside to do this activity. Now it could still be a reading activity, but I've taken them to a location that's going to help calm them because it might be a challenging activity for them. So maybe they might become dysregulated. So by removing them to an environment where they feel calmer and a space where they can be loud and expressionate if they need to be, everyone else in the room can also continue with their learning, because I have to think about all the other learners in the room. This isn't just about the high need in my room. Yes, supporting the high need is vital, because if they can't get on, no one can get on. But I need to also prioritize everyone else and remember that everyone in that room is my responsibility to get 100% of my time and my attention. So the Blossom target sheets paired with the learning libraries makes that smoother and much easier to manage.
This is all such music to my ears, hearing that you're using the visuals and that it's about location. That gives so much more independence and predictability to these children, doesn't it? I'm just wondering though, because I taught schedules in a similar way in my room, and it's so adult heavy to teach it initially. They become very independent with it once they know it, but before they know, you know, how to take it off and how to match it or whatever you're doing. With only 2 adults in your room, how are you teaching how to use visuals?
It's a bad question.
People often try it and then they think, no, it was too chaotic. They didn't understand it and give up on it. So it's really important, I think, that teachers hear, you know, what is the reality and how to make it work.
It has been a labour of love over the last few years. One of my biggest bugbears with visuals is I love them. I adore them. I love my Now and Next board. But it is so time consuming to have a visual for absolutely everything. And actually, they don't need a visual for absolutely everything. So to take it down to, I just have, again, back to the barrier we have of space and staffing, I've got work table, carpet, library, sensory tent, outside, woodland area. That one's more likely to be used if we're going out as a class anyway to do some woodlands, and the hall. So if it needs to be something like with our gymnastics equipment, then it will be in the hall. Or if they're coming with us to PE, it will be the hall symbol. So I've taken it down to seven symbols of locations so that it is easy. The color coding was massively important. Everything that they have is color coded. In fact, I've probably got one at my side. Yeah, so even their folders with their blossom targets in are color coded so that staff can see which folder they need to grab just quickly. And the children learned very quickly that although the schedule has a picture of their face on it, they very quickly learned, oh, I'm orange. So anything that's orange is mine. Their book is orange. Everything that theirs is orange. It can be heavy to set up originally, but it is so vital. I also reduce the visuals that we have the rest of the time. So if it's time for schedule, then I haven't actually got my visuals with me because we're not back at school yet, that's tomorrow. But on my now and next board, it would have this schedule sign here, and then it would show just choosing. So we do have a choosing board up on the wall. However, the children are at a place right now where they're quite happy to go and choose from what is around in the environment. They know the room enough now that they just go and help themselves.
Which is
But
great, isn't it?
it is
It's
amazing.
great that it's independent, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it took some doing, obviously, to start with, and some need a bit more guidance, which is when you can then grab the choosing board and just guide them back down to, especially if, the marble run is not out today and they're desperate to have it out, then we can take them back to the choosing board and show them what is available. But by just narrowing it down to those key visuals of schedule, choosing, that's most of your learning for the day done. You'll have wash hands, you'll have toilet, you'll have snack, those sorts of visuals. But around the room, we've also got individual core boards, or around my neck most of the time because we have smaller ones as well. What I found was our speech and language team are amazing and trying really hard to help with reducing workload for us, especially when there's such a delay with seeing a practitioner. But they're giving such generic core boards and saying, try using a core board to help them with speaking. It wasn't working because these symbols and signs and words didn't match what vocabulary they already
What they
had in their
wanted.
mind.
Yeah, right.
So
If a child's really
just
into
have to.
dinosaurs, balls and Chris and they weren't on there, well, it's not going to motivate them to use it, is it? Yeah, totally.
And like eating is one of the sort of things for a few of mine that they're going to have the same food in their lunchbox every day. So we just started with the food that's in their lunchbox. So it's now tailored to them. They then learnt to use the core board independently to ask for things to be opened at lunchtime or to ask what they would like to eat next. So now I can move it on to other symbols
Brilliant.
across the
Food
classroom.
is highly motivating, isn't it? It's a great place to start. And then they'll learn, oh, when I touch that, it actually makes things happen. And then when they see it in another area, it won't be as shocking because they'll have already practiced it over and over again. And snack is such a predictable environment. Like you say, they probably have the same things every time they eat in the same order at the same time. It's safe to practice those new skills, isn't it? To then take it out into the wider world of other places in the classroom. I love that.
You said about, it's a lot to teach children to use the schedules. Yes, it is. But I also try and lead the room as though every child in that room is on the spectrum. Now, I know that we don't say that about ourselves. You can't say that you're on the spectrum. But if I think of everyone as being there and I tailor my room to be as though I have every individual, including staff, as spectrum-based, then a lot of our practices meet the needs of our highest need and just support the needs of the neurotypical. So we always use our
Absolutely.
spot timers. So the whole class know the spot timers, and you can have larger ones, you can have smaller ones if you need. So these are tailored again for each individual. Sometimes you might think, I only need two spots. I've got to get through this quickly. Or children, we're in play and learn now. You have five spots until play and learn will finish. That could last an hour and a half, but we're still using that process.
Like good practice, good orders of practice is just good practice, isn't it?
It's very much
And a child might be
choice.
feeling particularly anxious that day, or not have heard a certain instruction that day or feeling a bit distracted for whatever reason, it might just be the day, the time, whatever, just having that visual reduces anxiety so much. They won't feel patronized by it. It just supports them. My staff love the visuals and the predictability and the routine. I tell you what, they cannot wait to get in tomorrow, even though they're a bit nervous about getting up in the morning and getting the kids ready. But they can't wait to go back to routine because we all need that, don't we? We all feel safe and secure with timetables, routine, predictability, structure, all of those things that a class provides. I don't think I've heard of any mainstream class, especially early years class, that does it like you do. And it is wonderful to me to know that it is possible, because I'm saying this stuff like visuals, schedules, and then, but in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, am I being completely unrealistic here? Is it just totally not possible? Is it totally outlandish to think that a teacher could do this in a mainstream class? And I cannot tell you how wonderful it is to hear what you're saying, that of course it's possible. You just have to, like you say, go autism friendly first.
And it's picking what you need to do first and sticking with that. So if you haven't got spot timers in your room, introduce them first and just introduce spot timers. And it's about being consistent with them. It is about using them every single time. And that's really hard sometimes when you've got your neurotypicals that you just want to say to them, all right, children, play and learn's finished. We need to tidy up. We need to get to phonics because they can follow that. But you need to use the spot timer every single time for every single thing that you do, every transition that you do, because the one time that you're going to need it when there's a dysregulation, it won't work, because if you're not using it consistently, a child's not going to respond to it. It needs to be there every single time. So yes, it is doable. I mean, 2 years ago when I had my three high need join me all of a sudden partway through the year, I wouldn't have said it was possible. I pretty much was swimming to sort of just keep up and stop myself from drowning. In doing so, it's so rewarding working with these children, but the guilt you feel as the teacher about everybody else and have I given them everything made me think about how can I do this so that everyone gets the best of me and the best education that they can. And don't get me wrong, I've had parents in even this year concerned about the level of SEN that we are receiving as a school and concerned their children are going to be not pushed to where they need to go. And I've been able to show Blossom as a structured curriculum for the children that are not accessing mainstream and then show my timetabling for the children on mainstream curriculum. And that has really helped parents to understand that I have thought this through. So this is not me just going, oh, we're going to just manage each day. This has been thought through and is there for everyone's needs, not just for the high need. But I do believe that if you can support the high need, the neurotypicals will be able to access their learning better. But include them, include the other children in what you do. So the other children know how to use the core boards. They know where they are in the room and they can take the children that cannot yet verbalize in words over to them to try and get them to point to me. I've had children come over and say, Miss, I don't know what so-and-so is trying to say to me. So rather than just ignoring them in play, they've become aware that this child is trying to communicate with me and I don't know what to do about it. So they come and sought help because they see us interact with the children all the time.
Starting so often it's, well, how can we get these sensory learners to integrate and be included in mainstream? Well, you're flipping that on its head. You're saying, let's ease all of our anxiety. Let's build a structured and predictable environment for all of us. All of a sudden, we're inclusive. Like nothing else has to be done you're modeling all of the time that we all have these needs. We all want, it doesn't matter what your diagnosis is. We all benefit from the visual board. We all benefit from having warnings and, you know, whatever it is. And your children are so acute. They're so clever. They just pick that up because you're modeling inclusive practice all the time. You don't have to say, we need to include, because you're just doing. So then they're just doing.
These children are going to be very inclusive young people and will grow up to be inclusive and carefully minded adults who have experienced this, because need isn't going away. These children, especially the ones with diagnosis, aren't going to get better, if that's the way to put it. They have to be in society with everybody else. So it is one of those where actually if children are exposed to it, then that's great. I speak to all of my children very openly. If I think about phonics, if we do read writing because of school, we are put into different groups based on what sounds you know. I talk to the children all the time. We change their books together and I say to them, remember, you learn what you need to learn when you need to learn it. So don't worry if your friend has gone into a different group. They are learning something that you're not, but you will learn it when you're ready to learn it. And that is how I approach everything in the classroom. And it's a phrase I use with them a lot. You will learn what you need to learn when you need to learn it.
Yeah, I love it. It just validates everything, doesn't it? It validates your staff team as well, I'm sure, of that are maybe coming to you and not feeling as confident as you are in all of this. Again, it's you'll get there. Just focus on this one job and we'll get, like, it's almost like you're embedding a whole classroom of learners, adults and children. I'm just wondering, though, this sounds so perfect and wonderful. What happens when they leave your room? Are the teachers on board? You know, because it sounds to me so crucial that you've kind of cracked it and it sounds incredible. Yep. Do those colours stay the same when they go to the next room? Like, do they still have time to, do they still have spot times? What happens in the rest of year one?
So myself and year one work very closely. We have a shared outside area as well. So amazingly in my school, we are just a team that just adore working together. It's as simple as that. And we had Ofsted actually in October of 24, so not long ago. And even in that Ofsted, so the report has been published. It's very, very positive about what our school does about inclusion and SEN and how children with SEN will thrive in a mainstream setting at our school, which is just, it makes you so proud because we work so hard at it. So every member of staff has a spot timer on their lanyard because the time you're going to need it the most is normally through transition time. So when you're collecting them from the playground, you have your spot timer on you. There are core boards up around the school. So yes, Blossom is something that I am pushing into year one. So I've gone backwards first into sort of our nursery and looking at how we transition from nursery into reception so that hopefully we can try and get some of the paperwork earlier, even though, you know, agencies do tend to push back at you and say, oh, they're only three, it'll be developmental. So there's other barriers there. But no, I support heavily our year one and our year two with ideas for how they can move on. Now, I'm an early year specialist. Blossom will work into year one because it's highly likely that they won't have met all of the developmental steps up to the end of reception, otherwise they would be on the reception curriculum. So it's highly likely that they will just take the folder up and you can continue with that. The only difference once they go into the Key Stage One classroom is the environment doesn't lend itself as easily. So it is something that we're now looking into. So our children that currently are off curriculum are in the classroom in their own work table and workspace. By this time, they tend to have that full-time adult or at least part-time adult that they need because we've done the paperwork in reception and done the legwork. So that means that adult can look at that planning. So rather than necessarily having a learning library set up, although I would argue a learning library would still work beautifully, and it's something that as a senior leader within the school, I am going to be looking to try and introduce. It means that we can still use that location and sort of process where we can say, right, this child's going to come and do this activity, we're going to do it in the hall, or we're going to do it in the hub where we can do some cooking together. It is really thinking about that inclusive curriculum of we don't need them to be learning the same as everybody else in their classroom, but they do need to be accessing the learning that they need to learn. They need to access their peers for that social. They need to access what they can at their age-related level. You wouldn't put a neurotypical child who can't read into a year two reading comprehension. You wouldn't do it. So why would you do it to a child that's got SEN? You don't need to.
Yeah, it feels unfair. And for the sake of, we always say, lots of people have heard me say this, but it's not inclusion, it's just including them. It's actually excluding them because what's going to happen? They're going to either dysregulate or zone out or think that learning is boring or the classroom isn't for them, and then you're on to a lose-lose there, aren't you? And someone has asked, do your children ever always follow their year group, or might they repeat reception sometimes? Have you ever had that?
Yep, so no, they follow their year group. You'd have to apply to county to get them to stay in the a year group that isn't their biological year group. If I can get in there soon enough in nursery and I genuinely feel that there is a significant detriment to their progress to come up and you have enough evidence, we can put to county in nursery to get them to start a year later. However, you've got to be really sure that what they're going to gain by doing an extra year in nursery would be beneficial to them catching up. Now, we've had a few children do that. We've also had a few children that maybe you would advise would stay back have come up and actually it's been beneficial for them. So it's really about those key individuals. But as far as I'm aware, and I might be wrong with this, but as far as I'm aware, if you're going to have a child resit a year group, you have to apply to have that done, because at some point they would have to go back to their biological age.
Right.
Because we've talked about this with some of our students before who might have to, they could maybe do primary with the wrong age group, with biological age, but the secondary school doesn't have to adhere to that decision that we made and could make them go back into their correct year groups.
Yeah,
you've got to be really careful.
Not as easy as just, oh, let's just keep them back, they can go ahead and they work.
I think sometimes it's too easy to think, well, let's just keep them in reception because that's where they play. No, if you look at what they actually need to learn and what they need to progress, which is what Blossom is doing, then actually you can target learning provision for them because you can take them to the location that they need to be. That doesn't mean they can't come into my classroom. I have a year two child that comes in for his phonics lessons with me because we do a special communication group, which is looking more at that attention and listening because they are all non-speaking children. So yes, we're teaching them reading and lots of them can identify words and sounds, but they don't use speech as their communication tool. So we're doing a phonics-based activity group just for them, which is led in my classroom, whilst the rest of the school is in its individual grouped areas for phonics. So it means that the right children are going to the right spaces. Sometimes to hold them back, is that just because it's easier space-wise for adults?
Yeah, or easier planning wise, easier yeah. Adult organising wise. Yeah, it's definitely the easier option, but I totally agree with you that it seems short-sighted that you've done all this work for their peers as well. You've done all this work about inclusion and that we all have these needs and we're meeting, and then all of a sudden, oh no, you split now because that doesn't mean anything. You know, they're all local kids and I'd love to think that they were going to be teenagers and adults that live in the same community, right? And that support each other way beyond yeah. school, way beyond you yeah. will ever know.
Yeah.
They will see each other in the town or in the shop and they'll know each other. They'll have a really solid relationship there and what an equal relationship. And I think that will only happen if we try to keep them together. And also that's how government are going now. You know, all the reports that are coming out from the government talks about inclusion, and what they mean by that is keeping the children in the classroom as much as they can access within their actual age year group. And so we're going to have to find a way of making that work
yeah.
early years and way beyond, you know, yeah. way up to year six with, you know, we've got some of these zones that no, don't all get an AHCP and leave, like you yeah. were saying right at the beginning. We have great need in our mainstream classroom, children that could way be in my class. I mean, we've got children in mainstream that are working at a lower level than children in my class. Like, let's yeah. just, you know, let's not assume that, you know, if you're a lowest ability, you definitely get this provision. It absolutely doesn't work like that at yeah. all. And I'm seeing that firsthand in my room. So the only other option is to make our classrooms, make our mainstream classrooms, yeah, more autistic friendly ultimately. And also, as you were saying, I have, you know, I've got to think about my most able students as well. Let's not forget that some of those will be autistic too. You know, they're so good at language, they're so good at reading, and they're so good at communication and maths, maybe because they're also on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And yes, they're great at academic subjects maybe, but also they probably are really anxious, they probably have unmet sensory needs as well. So the fact that you are meeting it for everybody also supports those high achievers that
yeah.
are autistic too, doesn't it? Yeah. Someone has asked, where can I find a spot timer? Do I need to make my own? So if you show yours again, it looks like cut up card, laminated with a bit of Velcro. So I'm sure you can make your own, but do you know of anywhere that you can get them?
I can post post the template onto my social media, or people can message me and I can post the template. But it is as simple as just some spots with Velcro on either side, so that when you take the spots off, you've got somewhere to keep them. Little hack for people, because we do a lot of laminating, somewhere like Hobbycraft or something like that, they do have circular cutters, so you can just place it in the middle and it cuts it out in a perfect circle for you. Saves a lot of time.
Amazing. Yeah, we make ours personalized. Ours are actually in a strip, so that saves that circle thing, but it's a similar thing. And we just have the pictures of their favorite items on there, again, just anything that tries to let them motivate them to want to engage, really. But yeah, a similar thing. Countdown, nearly finished, really nearly finished.
Yeah.
Finished.
I did see someone say that they hadn't seen spot timers before. So a spot timer, very basically, is your timing system. They can last seconds or they can last minutes. It's completely down to you. I think there was one occasion where I took my small spot timer with me, which was silly on my behalf. I should have taken a larger one into a collective worship, because we're a Church of England school, and the child, who normally manages absolutely fine, decided today really wasn't having this and kept looking at me going, home, and I had to make two spots last about 20 minutes. That was rather challenging, but I use it alongside my Now and Next as well. So I might say two spots of, so we call it singing for them, for our collective worship, then home time, because it's always at the end of the day. So they can then see that the time they've got left, and they can see what it is they're doing and what's coming up. So that's why I have a smaller one attached to the Now and Next.
Yeah, great. It works both ways, doesn't it? It works if they don't like the thing, like you were just saying, and they want the thing next. But it also works if they're loving the thing, but don't want to give it up. Like, this thing is coming to an end soon. So you can kind of use it in both ways. They're fantastic, aren't they? I get lots of questions and concerns from adults saying, oh, I couldn't cope with it not being an exact time. But actually, I find the benefit is you can work alongside that child, all the things. They say, for example, singing. Well, that's not necessarily an exact time, is it? It doesn't always end at exactly the same time. It would be at the end of a song.
Yeah.
So then you can time it perfectly to end at the end of the last song, and we're out of here.
Yeah.
Whereas if you use something like a timer or a watch or a stopwatch, it might be too short, it might be too long. It's really hard to know the exact time. And as soon as it becomes unpredictable and not consistent, you've lost them. It's just about keeping that promise, isn't it?
Yeah. And everyone has to be consistent with using them. Otherwise, they just don't work. On the rare occasion where I've not got my lanyard on, or a situation's come up where I need my spot timer, because we use them so consistently, I was able to easily transfer it into three fingers and then finish. So if you've used that process again and again, all of a sudden it doesn't take long. So I advise parents, I always give parents a spot timer if we're using them in school, and show them how to use it, and say, I would use it when you have to go shopping. If you've got to take them with you, use the spot timer so that they know it's coming to an end. But if you forget your spot timer, you've got fingers. You've got five fingers. So just say five spots and then shopping is finished.
I think that's
so that they can see.
The great thing about it being five and it being a circle, because actually it can very easily transition to your hand, can't it? It's quite a similar enough visual, isn't it?
Yeah.
To do that. Somebody has said, if you had a neurodivergent child who didn't get on with a TA, what would you do? And I think that's an interesting...
Yeah,
that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because ultimately, you've got one TA, you haven't got a choice. I'd like to hope that all the staff team are using the same systems, the same language, the same voice. But it's probably, if they don't like them, it's probably an inconsistency in that. So maybe I would look at more staff.
I think you'd need to stand back and you'd need to see what is it. I mean, most of our neurodivergent children wouldn't be able to explain why they're feeling like that. I certainly know what this person means in terms of, you can certainly see sometimes it can be something as silly as your perfume's too strong. Yes. So I can't be near them because their perfume's too strong. Sometimes it's that the person isn't necessarily being as consistent. It's your body language as well. It is really hard. And I find it, especially in early years, is for all children, whether they're diverse or typical, you are helping them to learn what their emotions are. And it's never okay for a member of staff to be hurt in their workplace. But we do expect the temper tantrums and the lashing out that you need to stand back from, and you need to register that, oops, I caused that, right, let's just calm this down, let's not do that one again, and reflect on your own practice. But you need to be there and open. You need to, it doesn't matter that you just caught me on the arm when you were cross with me, we're going to go past that, and you're going to see that I'm here, and I've not left you, because the children that need you the most will push you away the hardest, and they need to know that you are still there and that you are waiting.
And I'm sure that your commitment to how you run your classroom, like, you can see it all the way through this hour that I've been speaking to you, you can see how passionate you are and committed you are to it. That is infectious. So if you're speaking to your team that this is how we do things, it works. Yeah. There's so much trust and belief there that that's going to help consistency. Whereas if you're a bit fluffy, if you're saying, oh, should we try this? What do you think? I don't know, should we try it? Oh, it didn't work really, did it? What else can we try? You know, if you're just bumbling through like that, that's going to give absolutely no trust to your team at all. And they're going to do it their own way. And that is a real issue.
I think you've got to also be aware that sometimes there's only so long you can be screamed at for, especially like if I think of a child that I've had that's had ODD, there's only so long you want to be shouted at or have chairs tipped over in your direction. Actually, you need to tag out with that TA. I check in with my staff every day. How was your night the night before? Are you feeling okay? Because sometimes you're just in a good mood yourself, and you can't help regulate a child if you're not in a good place. So sometimes you can just say, right, you take my lessons today. I'm tagging in and I'm doing this because I'm not allowing that child to upset you to a point where they have control over the situation. So we're a team. I tag in, you go and do something else. That child will then very clearly see that they've lost that adult, and they will be very concerned about, oh, hang on, what's happened here? But guess what? The barrier is still the same. The question or the activity that you've been asked to do by that adult is still the same. I'm still going to make you do it. So I think you also need to be aware that it is normally RTAs that have to put up with the brunt of our temper tantrums and children that really struggle. You've got to jump in and tag in just as regularly as they do. Otherwise, they're going to think that they just get all of the lashings out.
You don't. If you're not that person, you might be asking something very unrealistic of your team. Because as soon as you're in their shoes, in that situation, if you're not doing what you say you should do, then that's a real issue, isn't it? You need to be standing there in their shoes, in that exact scenario, and showing them, this is how it's done. This is what I mean when I say, use this voice, use this body language, guide them over here. This is what I mean. This is what it looks like. The worst thing to do as a team leader, and we do it because again, we're human, but the worst thing we do is don't follow our own plan when it comes down to the heat of it. Because all of a sudden you've lost all trust and all faith from the children, but also from your team. Absolutely.
And you know what? Sometimes you just have to own the bad days and go, do you know what? Today did not work as planned. And check in with your team. If you think someone went home a bit quieter than normal, either give them a ring if they're someone that will pick up the phone. If you think, actually, I just need to give them a gentle message, and I'll give them a text just to make sure that they're okay and that I noticed that you seemed a bit down, you know, take that pressure off them and say, it's my room, it's my responsibility, please don't worry that today went wrong, we are going to reflect and we are going
to
change this
to it, and we'll find out and we'll come up with a solution. Absolutely, everything you're saying is so fabulous. Somebody's just said it's such a great live, and I completely agree. I feel really energized by this. I think it's a really important conversation to have. I need more people to know about you and know about your practice. Where are you based? Don't say the school, but where, what county are you in?
In Cornwall, Cornwall.
So I'm going to come and visit, if that's okay.
You come on in.
Yeah, I want to come and visit. I want to see it for myself, just for me sharing on here even more than my own practice, actually. Yeah. Because it will really help me to explain when I'm getting the questions from mainstream teachers that I'm getting. I want to be able to confidently say, this is what you can do. I've seen it work. I know it works. It just sounds it sounds fabulous. I know this is gonna help a lot of people, this conversation. So thank you so much for being here. I'm so pleased that your teaching assistant forced you on here, because you've shared some such great knowledge. So thank you, Anna.